Good afternoon and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Shelley Wozniak, filling in for host Kathleen McCoy. Well, she's on leave, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. On today's Justice Alaska, we're discussing the Alaska Department of Corrections with the DOC Commissioner Dean Williams. Correction is often in the headlines. Today, we'll go behind those headlines and behind the walls of Alaska's prisons to gain a better understanding of the system as a whole and those individuals and communities impacted by it. It's not a stretch to suggest that some feel the crime rate, particularly in South Central, is increasing. But is it really? Do public perceptions line up with the reality of the metrics? We'll dive into that topic and we'll work to gain a better understanding of the drivers of crime that lead to incarceration in Alaska. We'll also explore alternative models of confinement and reentry programs and the relevancy to what we can do here and what we can afford to do here in the 49th state. As always, if you want to join the conversation today, if you have thoughts you'd like to share or questions for Commissioner Williams, or if you've had experiences with the Department of Corrections you'd like to discuss, give us a call in Anchorage, Girdwood, or Eagle River. You can call 550-8433. In Seward, the Valley, or outside of South Central, listeners can call 1-800-550-8433. You can also email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And we also have my colleague and social media guru, Jessica Stugemeyer, in the studio with us. Say hello, Jess, so people know your voice.
Hi, everybody.
And Jess is here monitoring our social media pages, so you can tweet us at Alaska Public or direct message us from Facebook with your comments or questions, and Jess may read them on the air. Is that okay with you, Jess?
Fine by me. I'm ready.
Okay, great. I'd like to turn things over now to my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, who will tell us a little bit more about our guest today.
Thank you, and happy to have you here, Commissioner. And let me just do a very brief introduction because our program, we could probably spend 2 or 3 hours with you going over all of the things that Ms. Wozniak has said we're going to cover. Commissioner Williams came to Alaska in 1980 for the summer, and as his bio suggests, it turned out to be a very long summer indeed. He is still with us. He started his career in the Nome area as a juvenile counselor, worked in the youth facilities in Nome, and went to work for the DA's office for a period of time as an investigator, and then returned to corrections and has been with corrections off and on the entire balance of his career, with an emphasis in the juvenile area. He was the head of McLaughlin here in South Central. So without further introduction, Commissioner Williams, welcome, and we'd like to get started.
Sure. Hi. Thanks for having me, everyone. Judge, good to be on. Thank you.
Well, let's start the show today by getting the lay of the land here. Commissioner Williams, welcome to the program. We're very glad that you're here. And I'd like to begin by asking you to provide us with some basic numbers about the correction system in Alaska. So feel free to answer these in any order that you want to. I'm curious how many inmates, how many places of incarceration do we have? What are the different types of facilities that we have here for incarceration in Alaska?
Yeah, thanks, Shelley. So the first one is how many inmates do we have? Yeah, we have about 4,200 inmates in custody throughout 12 facilities. And we have a range of facilities. Probably many of your listeners don't know that we're a unified system. And a unified system means that we cover everything from small community jails. We support and fund small community jails funded through local police departments. So we have oversight, even though we contract those out and give money for them to run those places. Unified system, you know, so you get everybody from pretrial all the way to someone who's sentenced for maybe perhaps 90 years. And so our facilities cover, our state facilities cover the gamut of pretrial facilities all the way through long-term sentence. So we have 12 facilities all the way from pretrial facilities, and we even have a farm, Point McKenzie Farm. There's about 100 inmates out working on the farm right now as we speak, planting and weeding and getting the farm, getting the season ready to go, all the way to our maximum security facility, which is located in Seward, and it has about 400. That's Spring Creek. And so we have everything else in between. We have our largest facility is Goose Creek, and that has about 1,200 inmates. So total 4,200 inmates in custody. We have about another 300 or 400 in our halfway houses, and those are places that the department contracts with. So, total, when you take the halfway houses and are incarcerated, you're at about 4,700 total.
So I just wanted to follow up here with what's the superordinate goal or what's the mission of the Department of Corrections in your, I know what your official mission is from your website, but if you had to give me an elevator speech about what you feel the mission is, what would that be?
Well, I think it's several things. I mean, a unified system has a lot of moving pieces to it in terms of moving people back, you know, who are charged with crimes back and forth to court from the facility back in. But the overarching goal is really in a couple different buckets. One is our job is to secure confined people who are waiting for trial or have been sentenced. So part of that, you know, part of the entire justice system is taking people out of society and keeping them from us because they have violated laws, gone through due process, and been found guilty of a crime. And you know, and establishing norms and, you know, and establishing that there's a consequence for violating the law and taking someone out of the public. I mean, the capturing of someone's freedom is one of the greatest things we prize. And so the correctional system does that. And that part, I think we do a really good job. I mean, we take people out from their life and we incarcerate. And that's one bucket. The other thing that really comes along with this, though, that I try to remind people all the time is that 90-95% of the people who are incarcerated right now are coming back to our communities. And part of my effort as commissioner is to at least provide a way back for folks. So another part of our mission, of course, is to really try to rehabilitate and get people out so they get housing, get a job. That's the other bucket. The other bucket that is in my department, of course, is probation and parole. And so my department also oversees people who are on probation to try to keep them in line, try to keep them doing well, and encourage them and support them in their transition back into the community. So those are the kind of major pieces. I'll just say the last piece, of course, too, is with some of the recent law changes, we have now a pretrial department division that monitors people while they're waiting for trial, and that's a brand new piece for our department that's never been in existence before in a state. So that's kind of the general categories that I would mention.
And before we continue on here, I just want to remind folks, if you want to call in, we are talking to the Department of Corrections Commissioner Dean Williams on Justice Alaska today. You can call locally at 550-8433. Outside of the Anchorage and Eagle River area, you can call 1-800-550-8433. And you can also get a hold of us via social media by at Alaska Public on Facebook or Twitter. So you can tweet at us on today's show as well. Well, you named a few buckets there in terms of your mission. What are, and you talked about inmates going back to society, what are the recidivism rates in Alaska currently?
Well, recidivism rates, or for people who may not be familiar with that term, reoffense rate. A reoffense rate we measure for if someone gets out of prison, we follow them for 3 years. Are they going to return to prison within that three-year period? And our reoffense rate is not very good, and it hasn't been very good for quite a long time. The last time, their most reliable data goes back to about 20 years. And so the reoffense rate for the last 20 years has varied between 60 and 65% approximately. And so two out of every three people who get out of prison end up going back to prison. And more succinctly, actually within the first 6 months, almost 50% of the people who are going to reoffend within the first 6 months. And that's a clue as to where the problem is at, and for me as the commissioner. So that's our reoffense rate. It's not very good. Other states do better, and other countries do better, and that's sort of what I've been tackling since I've had this job.
And this is Elaine Andrews. When you say other countries and other states do better, how are we at the bottom of the heap here, or are we kind of in the middle ground? Can you give us some sense of where we are and when you're looking at other jurisdictions?
Well, excuse me. Sure. Yeah. No. The data is kind of tricky on this because when you have, to be totally clear, when you have a unified system, we're measuring people who are getting out who have any kind of sentence. So it could be a 3-week sentence or, you know, a 3-day, you know, sentence. And so we measure very short-term sentences. In other states, they may be only measuring people who get out. So when you talk about this data, it's kind of tricky. But overall, let me just say this. Our reoffense rate is not good and is compared to other states, we're below average, that's for sure, in terms of the reoffense rate. There's some other states whose reoffense rates, like Michigan, you know, it doesn't, some of these states you kind of think, wow, that's not a state I would expect who is doing well, but their reoffense rate is much better. It's about half of what ours is. And my colleagues around the country, you know, we discuss this issue commonly, and so we're not very good in terms of other states, and we're even worse in some ways when you compare to other countries.
Well, it seems to me that this seems to be a significant and important concern, because obviously you're not looking for more clients; you want less clients, and in fact, I was kind of astounded, really, to look at the graph that you have on your website, which shows the state population from 1984 compared to the incarcerated population starting in 1984 up to 2016. And unfortunately, it looks like the gap of people incarcerated The gap is getting smaller. In other words, there are more people being incarcerated. Even though the population has gone up, we are incarcerating more Alaskans than we ever have. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. One of the growing areas in population has been really our pretrial population. So the fastest growth rate that's occurred has really been in this area that we just passed some recent laws on, which is the pretrial area. So that area, and I think I'll try to get the number of years correct on this, but in the last 3 to 5 years, or maybe actually 10 years, I think our pretrial population has grown like 70 or 80% from what it was 10 years ago. So of the 4,200, 4,300 people I told you that are incarcerated right now today, about 40% of that, so almost half of who we have incarcerated, are pretrial people just waiting for a sentence. And that's the area that the pretrial division that was just stood up is really going to go after. And that's common with other states as well.
Okay.
But the overall incarceration rate around the country, we have kind of mirrored that, even though overall crime for the last 20 years, there's been the last year or two has actually gone up in some areas. Crime has gone up in some areas. But you know, we have increased incarceration in Alaska, which has kind of matched the rest of the country.
So this notion of, pretrial means they're not just waiting for a sentence, obviously. They may, in fact, not be guilty. I mean, they have been arrested based on probable cause, and they're being held. And if this is 40% of the incarcerated folks, you talked about the recent legislation. We're talking about Senate Bill 91 and the revisions in Senate Bill 54, I'm assuming.
Right.
Okay. Uh-huh. So talk to us a little bit more about this pretrial situation, because it's 40% of the people who are occupying a bed, and it certainly garnered quite a few headlines in terms of people being frustrated about people being in custody.
So just to be clear, we're talking about SB 91, the changes to the new legislation, which is, I believe, SB 54. And so if you just want to talk really briefly about those, Commissioner, and then we're going to go to the phones here in just a second.
Sure. The biggest, this has probably been the most area of confusion, in terms of some of the law issues. To be really clear, before any legislation was passed over the last couple of years, last year or two, people who have been charged pretrial or who get charged with a crime have always gotten out in the past. They continue to get out. The issue is getting smarter about who gets out and who stays in. And so people who have a lot of money who can get out shouldn't necessarily be getting out just because they have a lot of money. And people who don't have money who are really charged with really relatively low crimes maybe, in fact, should get out so they can get back to their job. So we've always had that. We inherited a very high failure rate of the pretrial population. 37% of the people who are charged with a new crime charged with a crime before they get to trial, 37% of those folks failed. In other words, they committed a new crime before they even made it to their court hearing. So the whole effort about pretrial is probably one of the most promising public safety initiatives because it puts armed officers on the streets monitoring these people when they should be monitored, and it gets people back out to their job when they should, and it keeps people in jail who should stay in jail waiting for their trial regardless of their ability to pay money. And so my hope is this, and this just started several months ago, this is the area where I think public safety can really be improved, and it has in every other state, every other 25 other states who have adopted the model. I've looked at the data on this very carefully, and I think we're doing absolutely the right thing on that. So that's what that that population was, the growing population prison system, and that's the area that the statutory changes directed us, the department, to launch after, and that's what we're doing.
Okay. Well, we're going to get ready to go to the phones here, but I just want to remind listeners that you can join the conversation by calling 550-8433, or if you're outside of the Anchorage Eagle River Girdwood area, you can call 1-800-550-8433. You can also email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org, or you can tweet at us or Facebook direct message us at Alaska Public. And I'd like to go now to Crystal, who is on the phone, who has a question for the commissioner. Crystal, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Thank you. My question is, why are inmates here in Alaska on charges of murder too serving 30 and 40 years, whereas in the lower 48, murder too, most of them are getting out after 10 years?
Well, thanks, Crystal. The area of sentencing is, and of course, I don't control any of that as the commissioner. And actually, with some of the reforms that actually passed in law, just just FYI, even though I have nothing to do with who's sentenced or who comes to me, I take people that are sentenced. Of course, the court decides that. A process is whole laid out, in terms of what sentencing guidelines are. But actually, with some of the reforms that occurred, actually the sentences for some of the more serious crimes actually went up. And so the mandatory minimums, like, for example, murder crimes and things like that, actually went up in some of the sentencing reform issues. But how we compare to other states, I don't really know what that looks like. And, of course, as Commissioner of Corrections, my job is to deal with the people as they come to me with whatever sentence they get.
Judge Andrews, you have any input for Crystal?
I don't. I just agree with the commissioner that he takes and executes the sentences that the court imposes upon people. And, without looking at data, I'm not confident that... murder too, it is a huge category, and it can be from really horrific to less than horrific, although every murder is horrific. But that's a hard one to answer in the absence of facts. But I would like to ask him, if I could, in terms of the pretrial programs you're talking about now that are just coming online, if maybe you can tell us something a little bit more about them.
Well, one of the things is that, first of all, the judge now has an additional tool to make a decision. So it's important that everyone remember that judges still make decisions with information. And there is some guidance in the law for judges to kind of consider. And it's kind of complicated, but I'm really generalizing now, but for the sake of simplicity. But there's a tool that we now give the judges called an assessment tool that is an objective tool. It just looks at criminal history. There was a problem with out-of-state history, and this is very complicated, which just got fixed with some language just recently passed in the legislature, and the governor hasn't yet signed this bill yet. The judge now has a tool they didn't have before. That's one thing. The second thing is that when I mentioned before that 37% of people were failing they were committing a new crime even before their court hearing. I mean, that's the system we inherited. I inherited, the department inherited. Now we have armed officers who are monitoring some of the people who are getting back out. So they make house calls. We check to make sure they're at their job. We check to make sure that they're not having any contact with their victim. Our officers have already arrested people who have shown up at the office, for example, with their victim in tow. And there's clearly a no-contact order. And so the only way that happened before is that the police would get another phone call. But now we're actually monitoring those folks and keeping track of them and waiting for them to get to court. There's a lot of data that suggests even just reminding people that they have a court date helps get them get to court. But for some of the people who would be back out anyway, even if this law didn't exist, we now have armed probation officers keeping track of these folks. And that is really a valuable component piece, I think, of really keeping track of these folks. So these are the folks, by the way, that are sometimes waiting for trial, still addicted to drugs, they still have any addiction issues. And trying to keep track of those folks, and if they violate and they have a problem, they're hauled immediately back to prison and brought back for the judge again. And by the way, they're charged with a new crime too. Those are the two major pieces of that changed.
All right. And when we come back from the break, I do want to revisit a little bit about what we were talking about in terms of the legislation and the populations that are being impacted by the legislation here in Alaska. But we're going to go to a quick break. Before we do, I want to remind you that the number to join us today on Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska is 550-8433. And outside of the Anchorage, Eagle River, and Girdwood area, you can call 1-800-550-8433. You can also email us hometown@alaskapublic.org or tweet at us at Alaska Public, or you can direct message us on Facebook.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. My name is Shelley Wozniak, and I am filling in for Kathleen McCoy, who is out on vacation. And I'm joined again with my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. And our guest today is the Department of Corrections Commissioner Dean Williams. So welcome back to the show to the both of you. I wanted to talk a little bit about the drivers of what's contributing to the upticks in some of the metrics that we see occurring in terms of incarceration. We all know that there's an opioid epidemic occurring, and I'm just sort of curious, when we're examining these numbers, and you're talking about these numbers today, do you tend to see the same people over and over in the system? Is there an uptick in new offenders? And if so, where are those trends occurring?
Well, thanks again for having me. This is a little difficult to generalize about the basis for it. You're absolutely right. We know, one, that the opioid crisis is one of the driving factors. That's one of the changes that's occurred in the last couple years. And any of your listeners have ever met or know of people who are addicted to opioids, it's a serious addiction. It takes over someone. They will steal your, coffee cup to get a dollar. It's just a horrible addiction, and it takes over people. So some of our uptick in crime we know is associated with the opioid crisis. There are people that are sort of chronics that we do see. We sometimes call people that are working life on the installment plan that are repeat folks who are chronic sort of individuals in the justice system, and many of them are a good portion of them have addiction issues. I don't know. I think it's, crime is just recently, it's been the last 2 years. Beyond that, I have a hard time sort of generalizing what the other sources are, whether or not we're seeing more people with certain levels of crime. We certainly know that one area is like vehicle theft, for example, has gone up, and I would think a big portion of that's attributed to the opioid issue and the drug issue that's sort of consumed the state, our state, and many other states.
but I don't really have a sense from the data I've looked at that we have more or less in the last year or two. We have, you know, we've been at the head of some really unsavory statistics in a very long time, sexual assault, sexual abuse of children. We've been at the, unfortunately, at the top of that list for our population base for quite a number of years. So I don't know what else to say about it other than to say our pretrial population has grown. We know that the opioid crisis has grown, and that has caused some of the issues recently with the uptick in some of the especially the property crime issue around the state.
All right. Thanks so much, Commissioner, for that answer. I'd like to welcome now Phoebe from Anchorage to the program, who wants to discuss treatment options. Hello, Phoebe.
Hi there.
What can we help you with today? What is your question?
I was just wondering, I know the commissioner's been speaking about getting more armed officers out there to help these folks be successful. I'd like to know what's happening in terms of treatment options or increasing support for people that have addiction issues as they transition back to our communities, because I don't know that much about it, but I do know that it's extremely hard for people to find treatment, and it doesn't seem like there is a seamless process for people as they're transitioning out of incarceration to actually access those kind of services in a manner that's equitable or easy. That's my question. I wonder what's happening. If there's any plans for more increased funding or programs.
Thanks so much, Phoebe. That's a great question. Commissioner?
Yeah, it is a great question, Phoebe. So I really appreciate this question. I'll tell you why. I think treatment behind the walls is very important, and I need everyone to sort of hear about that. I think there's a great importance in terms of what we do behind the walls. But here's what I've seen in a little over 2 years that I've been in this job. At one time in the state's history, there was a lot of treatment, and there was almost no treatment for some years, about 10 or 15 years, 20 years or so ago. And then we've now focused back on treatment behind the walls. And I still see the great value of it. But here's, I think, one of the heart of the issue that Phoebe is getting to, is that if you're an addict out on the streets, even if you're behind the walls, you're still an addict. And a lot of the failure rates that I've talked to, even about inmates, they are getting high. Many inmates I've talked to are getting high in the parking lot as they're getting out because they're still an addict. I have focused, and this has been sort of the drum I've been beating for over a year now, is that transitioning people from behind the walls to back to their home community is everything. And part of the attack of how we deal with not only heroin addicts, but just the reoffense rate in general, is getting people back to quasi-normal or figuring out how they can get back to a normal life. Because once you've had your freedom taken, and deservedly so, to be real clear, in many cases, deservedly so, but how you get people back is the key. And I have been going after duplicating what I see as smaller transitional housing. I just came from the governor's, the First Lady's volunteer awards. And a number of those people who received the awards today were folks who are offering transition homes and having housing for inmates who are getting out of prison. And we know this from research, and I know this from looking at what other states are doing as well as what other countries are doing. Getting people out, it's also the data tells us, because remind me, I said earlier, about the first 6 months, almost half the people fail within the first 6 months. And there's two things people need when they get out. They need a job, and they need a place to live. And if they don't have either one of those places, you're already starting at a deficit. And so, and then providing treatment and outgoing treatment on the way out. I started a program not long ago called Vivitrol Behind the Walls. It's people who are heroin addicts who get a Vivitrol shot. It's another kind of complicated subject, but basically it prevents you from getting high for about a month. We're piloting that effort. It's been done in other states. I think every state is struggling with what the appropriate response might be. But I try to remind people in the most gentle way possible, we're not going to punish people who are our way out of this problem with heroin addicts especially. They frustrate us. They make us angry. They steal our stuff. I hear all the stories. I mean, believe me, in my job. And if I thought we could punish our way out to them, believe me, that's what I would do. But every other state who's facing the same problem as we are, we know that there must be treatment options available for people. Not everybody's going to take it, but for every person we bring back to normal again, that's what reduces crime. So it goes back to the reoffense rate. When you have a 60-65% reoffense rate, every person who reoffends has now committed a new crime. So I think there are some not only treatment priorities behind the walls I've tried to advance, but really as people transition out, they need it probably as much, if not more, as they transition out as they were sitting behind the walls. And I've focused a lot of my effort. I've been on the news a lot about our halfway houses and the changes that need to happen there. So Phoebe's point is not lost on me. In fact, it's the one that I'm probably pushing around more than anything else in the department.
Thanks so much for your call, Phoebe. And we got an email that sort of dovetails onto that, Commissioner, and this individual asked that they not be named, so I won't do that. But the email says, I was incarcerated for a short time years ago, and I was shocked by how many older, widowed women were in jail. They didn't seem to have any resources, family or otherwise, on the outside to help them. I'd like to help. Are there any programs you suggest? If not, any programs in place, what other ideas do you have for people like me to help? So kind of going from what you're doing to what individuals in society who want to help can do. Commissioner, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do have thoughts on it. In fact, I started a program, and it's a new program. It's relatively new that we're calling. In fact, it was named by the inmates, called New Beginnings. And this program is actually started at our women's facility, but I've only piloted it there for about 5 or 6 months because I saw the same thing that your email sender noted, that people have lost, some people have lost all family contacts on the outside. So this program takes vetted volunteers. People sign up who volunteer. We vet them. We send two volunteers with one inmate. So an inmate who's, let's say, getting out in the next several months, who has no connections with anybody in that community, we match them up with a volunteer, and they go out and they go to either church services or they go to coffee. You know, we've just started the program. I think it's been in operation now 4 or 5 months. We're kind of working the bugs out at the women's facility right now. In fact, I was at church this last Sunday, as a matter of fact, and I saw one of the ladies there with two of the volunteers. So those are some of the efforts that I have put in place, because a lot of people do, a lot of people want to figure out how to help, quite frankly, get some of these people back out, and I want that as much as possible. That's just one of the things. There are other things we're doing too. We have a lot of faith organizations as well as other treatment people who come inside the facilities, but one of my goals is to sort of figure out how to mentor people back out who have been incarcerated for a while, who have no ties. That's one effort. I think we have of course, a long ways to go on this type of work.
Well, it's so clear that this is such a complex situation, because you have not only offenders coming out and needing to find a job, find a purpose, find housing, but they have family. So, there are families that need to be reintegrated with the offender, too. And there's children involved for both the incarcerated women and the incarcerated men. And one of the things that that I've seen, certainly over my career, is the high percentage of people with mental health issues who are incarcerated. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do for those folks while they're behind the walls, so to speak, and if there are any programs for people as they transition out that are directed towards people with significant mental health issues?
Judge, this is probably the area that that sort of bedevils me and my colleagues around the country, and that is that, we commonly say, and because it's true, that most correction systems in most states are the largest psychiatric facility in the state. And I think that's the case of us. And we operate a very acute unit in the Anchorage complex and a sort of a subacute unit. And if you go to the acute unit, you're going to see people who are active, schizophrenic, who have serious, serious psychiatric issues, that can't function in society, highly suicidal. It's just major challenging work for my staff. The staff who work on the unit are like angels because the work is very demanding. And so this, every state faces this problem of what to do with your most severe acute people. We have, we spend a lot of money and we spend a lot of effort to try to, you know, stabilize these folks behind the wall. I think we're doing as good a work as any other state. I think I have very good staff and I have very very good professionals who are dealing with a very challenging population every day. The problem with us, of course, though, is how do you get these people back out with these kind of serious issues? I don't have a great answer to it. I wish I did. I can tell you it's a topic of conversations between myself and the Department of Health and Social Services and others who work in these areas. I think the more that I can continue to go with the other areas in terms of transitional housing and how I find people just on even the less acute or less psychiatric cases, the better off we're going to be with the serious cases. And the reason why is if I can do better in terms of transitioning the less serious cases out, let's say psychiatric cases out, the more attention I can continue to develop programming and appropriate responses for the real serious cases we have behind the walls. So one of the things that just kind of goes real quickly along with it, though, is too, is just the conditions of confinement. And I'm doing everything I can to reduce sort of the severity in certain facilities of confinement, like solitary confinement. Because those things make people with psychiatric problems worse. And so making conditions of confinement more sensible at least is an effort to not make the situation worse with someone who comes to us.
Just a reminder for our listeners that you're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. The number to call and participate in the Anchorage area is 550-8433. Outside of Anchorage is 1-888-353-5752. You can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. You can tweet at us at Alaska Public or direct message us through Facebook as well. And we do have an email here from Janet. Janet says, my question for Commissioner Williams concerns who's best able to advocate on behalf of inmates and how. For inmates who are unable to advocate on their own behalf, whether due to mental health issues or simply fear of retaliation, when faced with issues ranging from denied mail or commissary, medications or medical issues to disciplinary or procedural issues, what can be done on their behalf? In the years we had a family member incarcerated, I made countless phone calls, emails, letters to POs, superintendents, most of which were ignored or unanswered, including a letter to the commissioner. I've asked our lawyers, who shrug and say really no one can advocate for them. How do we support them so that they're better able to transition back out?
Well, thank you, Janet, and I'm sorry that has been your experience. I guess one of my other sort of lifts or one of the things that I've tried to encourage all of my leadership staff is that we're going to be transparent about what we're doing right and what goes wrong, and we're going to be open and honest about what goes right and what goes wrong. And I have taken that charge from the governor very serious over the last little over 2 years. And so one thing I would tell Janet is, one, contact the ombudsman office. I do not view the ombudsman office as my enemy. I view them as an ally and a resource. Don't necessarily agree with everything, but I don't need to. The ombudsman office is, we have a working relationship and a talking relationship, and I forget the director's name right now, but I would encourage that. The other thing that I have said that I really care about is us being transparent about when things go wrong and how we hold ourselves accountable. And I started a professional conduct unit a little over a year ago, a year and a half ago, that whose job was to really hold the system, including me, accountable for things that don't go right. So I'm not sure, I think it's on our webpage somewhere, but that's another source of saying, hey, I think there's something going wrong. This is how I make a complaint. That's a professional conduct unit inside my own department. But if you want to not even report to my own department, report to the ombudsman office, because they do investigate certain things. They also bring things to my attention, and some of those launch you know, some of those issues that I launch my own internal, if we have a problem with a policy or we're doing a practice that is not good. Those are a couple avenues. There's a whole process, of course, internal process about how inmates make complaints. I encourage that. I take that system seriously. I think we have a ways to go in terms of improvement. But there is a system where inmates can make complaints through a process. And now we have a couple other tools in place with my professional conduct unit that actually, I think, allows for a much more honest and transparent review when there's a problem.
Great. Thanks for that answer, Commissioner. And Janet, we hope that answers your question. Thanks so much for your email. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Norway and alternative looks at how we do things in terms of incarceration. You're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Shelley Wozniak, and joining me, we have Senior Judge Elaine
Andrews.
Sorry. I lost my piece of paper somewhere. And we're talking to the commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Commissioner Williams is joining us as well. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 550-8433 or outside of the Anchorage metro area. It's 1-888-353-5752. You can also email us hometown@alaskapublic.org, or you can tweet at us at Alaska Public or direct message us through Facebook. And Judge Andrews, I believe you had a question for the commissioner.
I do. And before we get to the interesting question about how does Norway do it and how can we incorporate some of the successful things that they're doing, there's a real practical issue here, and it's money. I might be wrong. I haven't been actively involved in Senate Bill 91 or its revisions in 54, but I know a good part of the impetus was that we are spending money we can't continue to spend for the very expensive cost of keeping people in high security lockup institutions. And we want to take some of that money and not just reduce the corrections budget, but turn it into more effective dollars by doing the things that seem to work. So before we ask you about the things that seem to work that we want to use that money for, let me ask you, what kinds of costs are we talking about? What does it cost to keep someone in a at Seward or all of the costs that go into this?
Yeah, thanks, Judge. The average cost of incarcerate someone for one day, and the cost of this kind of go up and down depending upon, of course, where you're at in the state and particular locations. But the average cost is about $160 a day per person, and so it's expensive. And I commonly tell people those are valuable beds. And those are valuable cells, and we need them for people who scare us. And I have no problem advocating for incarceration for people who have done really serious, especially violent crimes, to protect the rest of us. But with that comes some real. We need to be real strategic and real smart about how we use those beds, and that's the sort of. The topic, or that's the sort of things that I discuss and that I've worked very hard to be very educated on and around this, around how other states are doing things and how other countries are doing things.
And speaking of that, on an April 4th story from KTOO, Senator Pete Kelly said that he remembered asking you in your confirmation, is there a place on planet Earth that has got prisons right? And you said you don't know, but if you find it, you'll let him know. And you and Senator Kelly, along with others, went to Norway last year to observe that system. So was Norway that place, Commissioner?
Shelley, I think it is, and I want to say this with this really important caveat. Alaska's not Norway, and I recognize that distinction very clearly, but surprisingly enough, a lot of what they have in terms of their population, they have a indigenous population in northern Norway. They also have a very large immigrant population, believe it or not, living in Norway. A big part of the prison population actually is about 30 or 40% of the prison population is actually immigrant populations. So, you know, the interesting thing about that trip was I took, I think I can say this about both individuals. I took Senator Kelly, president of the Senate, a conservative, a Republican. I took Speaker of the House, Bryce Edgeman, a Democrat. I think I consider both of them valuable, you know, important colleagues of mine, and very bright, maybe with different sort of agenda, you know, political views on certain items. I think we all came back from Norway saying, wow, there are really pearls of wisdom. You can't, not out to adopt a whole system in total or anything like that, but there were some real pearls of wisdom that no matter where you sat on the spectrum, that Norway had something to instruct us. And the first thing was is that they were at where a lot of states at, including us, were at 20 years ago. They had a very high reoffense rate, about 60-65%. They had violence inside their prisons. Their staffing was always problematic because working inside a prison is very stressful. Go talk to any of my staff, any correction officers, about what their job is like. It's not easy. It's a very difficult job. So part of my concern about making prisons safer was not only for inmates, but for maybe even more importantly for the staff. If you don't care about who people are like serving time behind the wall, please care about the people who are working there. And so there were some real pearls from them. One of the things that you, if you look at their statistics, about their reoffense rate is 20-25%. And that's not what it always was. It was what ours was. And they made some very strategic changes, and they brought down the reoffense rate. And they've made prison very purposeful, and they have very purposeful strategies about how they use prison. And it didn't matter what side of the spectrum you were on. You walked away and said, wow, there's something to learn there.
So along with that, I want to follow up with an email here from TJ. TJ says that you've noted that you support the Norway model, but that he believes that correctional officers need to be hired, that the corrections facilities are dangerously understaffed. He says officers are being forced to work several hours overtime each week, as well as being ordered to work their day off. What is your plan to bring more officers into facilities to alleviate the understaffing? And what's your plan to give current officers some relief from the fatigue of the many additional hours they're being forced to work?
Well, TJ's right in terms of the stressors on the staff right now. I've improved some of it when I closed down the Palmer Correctional Center a year and a half ago. I realigned about a third of staff. No one lost their job, and I took that sort of made that very difficult decision. But we are realigned and put those staff inside the facilities. The problem that TJ is mentioning, though, is the recruitment and retention that we have in the state right now, not only for correctional officers, but for also law enforcement officers. It's difficult to find people to work in these jobs. It's difficult to find people who qualify for them. And so I've been very supportive of every strategy I can think of. I am very much in support of a fair pay, fair salary, all the things that make these jobs attractive. The week on, week off is attractive. I support that effort. I think one of the things, though, is that if people understand the one way I can relieve stressors inside the prison system is having populations that are manageable for the staff that are working there. And so I have I don't have the crystal ball to fix the recruitment and retention problem with staff, but there are certainly some differences. I like to incorporate some of the Norway model. If you take a look at what happens with staff in that system versus ours, they're just much more they're safer. They're safer systems, and their staff just look better. They don't look so beleaguered like our staff do. And so I'm not disagreeing with TJ. There's a problem, and it's one that I inherited when I took this job. I think we're a little bit better, but that doesn't really get us to where I think we need to be as a system, and that, of course, is what I've been working on.
Let me ask you. We had the FBI director on during the last program, and he talked about the difficulty, the obstacles to becoming an FBI agent. When you say you have difficulty recruiting, finding people who are qualified, what are the qualifications for a correctional officer? What are the barriers to hiring people? And what's the salary range?
Well, the one of the major barriers is the difficulty of the job, I think. I think the pay is very reasonable. I'd have to go back and take a refresh. I remember what a starting salary is for a correction officer. It's a range of 11 in the state system, and I'm not sure where that falls at, but you can quickly move up. To be a correctional officer too, you move up in ranges. You get paid a little bit more working as a correctional officer than you do some of the state positions. But in terms of salary ranges, it's very decent. You're in the $45,000 range and higher as you kind of move up. And there is a lot of overtime, which is unfortunate, but that also increases the salary. The barriers, one is the people who want to do the job, and I think the system is changing, and we have a lot of varieties. And so I'm hoping anyone who's listening hears me, that there are many places, and from all the way from the most secure facility to the farm and everything in between, where staff can work and find a place like, yeah, that's the place for me. The one of the barriers is just sort of the background check and making sure that we have people working for us that, don't have, a sketchy work history or, any sort of criminal things. But again, I would hope that people would apply and then let us sort that out with you. It's really what I found the difference, and I'm trying to take us, is that in Norway, the people want to work to be what they call a prison officer in that system, because the working conditions for staff are quite different. And the tension is quite different. And I can't explain with our remaining 7 minutes all of the nuances of that, but I can tell you that it really has to do with that. Not only do you make the system better for the staff that are working there, of course, too, is that when you have a recidivism rate, they're very strategic about what they do behind the walls in terms of training, the purposeful interactions they have with inmates. They bring people from the outside in. They use something called dynamic security, which is a very intentional way that they interact with inmates. It's much more purposeful than what we do. So we have a ways to go to try to incorporate some of those pearls. And again, I'm not trying to recreate the entire system, to be really clear. But I think you have to say, hey, if our recidivism rate is 60-65%, what are we missing? What is this thing? What are a couple things we can do?
Well, along those lines, Commissioner, I just feel like I need to play devil's advocate here to some of this. So, do you feel like we live in a society where the public allows or feels that people who have been in prison have paid their debt to society? And what I mean by that is there's an element of public forgiveness about this, and we only have time probably for you to answer this sort of briefly, but when it comes to reintegration of prisoners, because the public is weighing their safety with giving this person a chance. So what would you say to that person who's skeptical?
Well, I'd say this, one of the quotes that said, there was quotes that said in Norway, which applies to us, doesn't matter what country, and who do you want to be your neighbor? And one of the guiding principles is who do you want to be the neighbor of the person who's coming out? I knew who I wanted to be. If there was someone who goes to prison, who's my neighbor, who goes, I want them coming back and having a job. I want them coming back with a purpose to live in their life. And so I understand, believe me, the anger. I talk to victims all the time who are victims of crime. The anger, the hurt, the pain that's associated with that. It's life-changing. And there's no getting around that. I can't change any of that as commissioner. What I can change is trying to make a change in our reoffense rate to reduce the future number of victims. And when I see other states that are doing that, and I see other countries that are doing that better than us, I think there is wisdom in just opening our mind to say, I want to do it better. They don't adopt everything. You'd be suspicious and skeptical, but you have to, at the same time, open your mind to say, I want the reoffense rate to go down in this state because that is going to be a better neighbor to me and to you and everybody else who's listening. And when 95% of people get out, the question we have to ask ourselves is, what kind of neighbor do we want? So that's the balance for me. Public safety is about reducing the reoffense rate, which reduces the crime rate.
Okay. Can you give me? I'm intrigued by this this Norway model. I know you don't have a lot of time, but can you give just one or two small examples? So when you talk about strategic change or doing things smarter, just one or two things that you saw.
Everybody person behind the walls who's serving a sentence either has a job, a training, or a purpose. Even if it's learning a musical instrument or something, everybody's going to be doing something. Idle hands are the devil's workshop, as my dad used to tell me. And so everyone behind the walls has purposeful activity, and that's invested in. And we think, well, that's going to cost more money, Commissioner, up front. Yeah, some of that does. Some of that means realigning money. Some of you don't need to have new money. You just need to realign the money you're having. But it also, when you have a reoffense rate of 25% versus 65%, well, that comes back to you in really profound ways. And so I would say when you walk into a prison in Norway, you see people working. You see people doing things. You see people studying. And you see people recreating. And the life behind the walls is a little more normal. Not because you want it to be softer or nicer. This says I'm not adopting any sort of philosophical precept here about how I'm directing the department. I'm looking for results. This is all about results. And when I see the results that other prison systems get, I want us to study that very hard. And I want to adopt small changes where we can. We're doing some of those things. I know we're kind of running out of time, but I just started a program today where we have inmates who are working at a seafood processing plant.
Well, that
and
Commissioner,
those are things we need to go. I think as a department.
I don't mean to cut you off there, but the music has started, which means that we're wrapping up the show today. I'd like to thank my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, and Department of Corrections Commissioner Dean Williams for taking time to join us. Thank you both so much. You can continue the conversation with comments on Hometown Alaska page at alaskapublic.org or on our social media pages on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search at Alaska Public. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Jessica Stugermeyer is our social media director. I'm Shelley Wozniak. Thanks for joining us today. Kathleen McCoy will return to the program next week for a conversation about entrepreneurship in Alaska. Thanks for listening and have a great rest of your afternoon.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.